This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Gifts from Guidance. And joining me from the Northwest in the United States of America is author and guest Kay Christie. Thank you for joining me today, Kay.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
This is a book of about 100 pages, so have you always had a desire to be an author? How did this come about?
That's a great question, Jay. I come from a family of writers in a variety of ways, and so I've always imagined that I could publish a book. This particular work came about through the process of automatic writing, which is, for me, a spiritual practice of journal writing, but releasing the words to my inner guidance system or to spirit to guide how the words come. So I've always been a journal writer and a diary keeper, and the progression into automatic writing was a natural for me. I started writing these pieces that I call prayers over about a 10-year period, and the anthology of them coming in the form of a book kind of came out of the fact that I had such a large quantity.
Yes. Is this does this fall in the general category of metaphysical, or is this spiritual only? How would you describe your book?
Well, this is a book of prayers and affirmations that I think have a wide audience. The way that I write is definitely metaphysical and spiritual in nature, but the message is broadly spiritual and is also of interest to people who are religious as their spiritual practice and connected to God, yet this book, connected to spirit, is still appealing to them.
Right.
So if that makes sense, you know, like
yes.
The method I use is quite metaphysical, but the message is very broad.
Well, one way to share that would be to perhaps read some of the excerpts from your book, because they fall in the category, although you've described them as prayers, they're somewhat like poetry in some regards as well. So share
yes.
with my listeners a little of that.
I agree with you. They kind of read like poetry, and so I'd be happy to read the title piece. The name of the book, as we know, is Gifts from Guidance, and this is the prayer of that same title. There is a place in our inner landscape that knows only of wholeness and love and faith. When we meet in this place, the possibilities of life are endless. The solutions appear with brilliant light and clarity. Follow a path or a meandering river to find this land and stay true to the song of your own heart. The guides speak only of love and possibility and infinite joy, holding the highest truth and deepest love as you journey forward. Listen to the space between your breaths. Become lovers with quiet and calm. Taste the colors of nature and then soar above it all and see perfection. We meet in this spirit-filled space and offer gifts of wealth and jewels for love, staff and crowns and robes for peace. You are majestic, royal, whole, and unique. Be guided to your gifts with ease and grace.
I can see why you describe this as inspirational. It is a motivational book as well, then. It really is
mm-hmm.
not just personally thinking of your own circumstances, but it's also looking at the outward and allowing that to affect you in a positive way. Would that be another way to describe your book?
Yes, that's lovely, Jay. Thank you.
Sure. The process, you say you are a journaler and have been doing this for a number of years, and what got you started on writing thoughts that were in this prayer format?
Well, really, the automatic writing process came for me through periods of my own suffering, where I was experiencing a heartbreak in such a way in my life that there was just nothing that comforted me. And when I used simple affirmations like, you know, everything is fine today. Love is all that exists. I am whole and unique. I would just play those kind of phrases over and over in my mind, and I noticed that I felt a little bit better. And even though my heart was broken and it was hard to get up and go any given day, when I could say some of the phrases that I wrote, like the world is filled with possibility, then I would go, oh, okay, well, if the world is filled with possibility, that's probably true for me too. And it would just lift my spirits. So I started sharing them with some of my friends and some of my clients, and they reported the same experience that these, what I call, as you say, what I call prayers, just kind of lift your mood and help you kind of plug into spiritual thought, and then, you know, your day or your life feels a little bit easier.
It sounds sort of like the junk in, junk out, or positive in, positive out, perhaps, would
exactly.
be another way to describe that. Yes.
Yes. And, you know, many authors, like Louise Hay being the master of positive thought and the use of affirmations as a way to live, it heavily influenced my life, and reading her work really changed me. And so then when the writing started to come in that affirmative way, I'm like, oh, you know, I'm not the first one to think of it. This is just my particular way of, you know, getting to the same result.
Your book is a book that there may be some others in the marketplace that are similar. Do you think yours has a unique approach, or maybe just the personal content that makes it stand out?
Yes, I think the unique approach of this particular book is the spiritual and not religious nature of it, that it will meet people wherever they are on their spiritual journey. So if someone reads this book who's really never thought much about spiritual practice or had much of a spiritual life, they can read the work and go, oh, you know, I understand the beauty of this piece. And you can also have someone who's been a spiritual practitioner for years or is a minister or, you know, very much engaged in their daily life in religious or spiritual practice, and they're going to read the piece and find meaning at their own level of understanding.
Yes.
So I think these pieces meet people wherever they are on their spiritual journey. If you're a beginner or highly advanced, you're going to find a beautiful message. And I think that's what makes it stand out.
Well, great. To tell my listeners also a little of your coaching experience and what you do in the coaching area. Is it all related to the contents of your book, or are there other areas that you are involved in coaching?
Right. I have a master's degree in behavioral science, which is the study of human behavior. And in my coaching practice, I really work with clients on personal effectiveness. So that might be a focus on spiritual practice and, you know, how they want to have spirituality as a part of their daily life. But it might be something like coaching people through the process of changing careers or changing a relationship or preparing for adding children to their family. I mean, it's really about effectiveness as in our personal lives and as a person moving forward. That might include spirituality, but it might not. And my coaching practice is quite broad in that way.
And you've been at that for, what, over 35 years, I think. Is that also correct?
Yes, wonderful. Exactly.
Right.
And I worked for government here in Washington State for many years and did management coaching and executive leadership coaching. And at the time that I made a career change, I really wanted to expand what I could offer people to be more deeply personal and less focused on just their work life. And so I took on a wider frame for the coaching work.
Your book is, again, just about 100 pages. If you were to describe this to someone and get them interested, how would you put it into a written, I'll call it a sales pitch, it's not really, but just an introduction?
Well, I would say this is the kind of book that you don't need to read cover to cover. It's a daily reflection book, so you could have it on a bedside table or in a bathroom or on the kitchen table and pull the book in the morning and just open it to a random page, and that could be your thought for the day. And you could read the prayer throughout the day and use it as a way to lift your spirit, lift your mood, set the course of how your thoughts are going to travel throughout your day. So, you know, you certainly could read it cover to cover, but I think people find the most pleasure in using it as a daily reflection book.
It's a good idea to have positive input, obviously, every day. Most of us are bombarded with negativity around us. If you look at television and the news or anything else that's happening. So positive input is absolutely a great recommendation. You have mentioned that you are a journaler, and keep track of your thoughts and have content that you keep track of on a regular basis. Are you planning a follow-up book to this?
Yes, my next book will be focused on my path to recovery from addiction and alcoholism, which I've committed to as a life for over 35 years now.
Fabulous.
And I imagine that the next book will also be an anthology of prayers and written pieces, and the story that I will tell will be recovery-based.
Oh, that'll be great. I look forward to talking with you once that is released. The title includes the word gifts. How does that relate to your desire for distribution in this book?
Oh, thank you for asking, Jay. I do see this book as a gift. The prayers come to me as a gift, and I love giving them away. One of the things I have started is something called the Encouragement Project.
Beautiful.
Where I get funding to give the books to women who are incarcerated, women who are in drug and alcohol treatment centers, and women who are in safe housing programs. And I want to get this book in the hands of women who can find comfort in the spiritual message but may not have the financial resources to purchase a book. So the Encouragement Project makes it possible to get this in the hands of those women.
Fabulous. And they can find out more about that, I guess, on your website as well.
Yes, there's a tab on my website called The Encouragement Project, and that's where you can get that detail.
This book is titled Gifts from Guidance, a book of prayers and affirmations offering comfort, encouragement, and possibility as we create our daily lives. My guest, right. Kay Christie. Kay, my listeners may want to get a copy of this. How do they find it?
You can get it online, Amazon.com or BalboaPress.com. Also, contact me through my website for an autographed copy.
Oh, fabulous. Very good. Thank you.
I do have a website, www.giftsfromguidance.com, and I post blogs and talk about kind of how my writing is maturing, and I would love to have people go there and sign up on that mailing list as well.
Well, thank you for the positive input. Great talking with you. Again, the title, Gifts from Guidance. And our guest, Kay Christie, C-H-R-I-S-T-Y. Thank you for joining me today and look forward to visiting with you in the future.
Good. Thank you, Jay.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff. and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Welcome to Author Voices On Air, and I'm your host, Rick Bell. Our next book, Growing Old in Newtown, is a true saga of an African-American family that sprouted from the fallow soil of poverty, domestic violence, and obnoxious weeds of bigotry. This memoir follows the author and his family through their struggles, dramas, and triumphs, providing an accurate depiction of life in Crow South from the 1950s to the 1970s. And joining me today to tell us more about this very personal story is the author, Michael E. Goings. Welcome to the show, Michael, and thank you for joining me. As I mentioned in the introduction, it is very much a personal story. Can you start by telling us a little bit about how this story became the novel that we're talking about today?
Well, it became the novel, or should I say the biographical work of myself, because for years I've always had these memories and these recollections of things that I had gone through. I was fortunate to have a good memory going back to 2 years of age, and things just kind of just was in my head, a memory that I wanted to put in print. And so that's how it really started. You know, I call it the good, the bad, and the ugly things of my life that had to shape me, what marked me, what marred me, what made me. And I wanted to share it, you know, in an autobiographical form.
Now, you talked there about sharing the story, sharing your life with the reader. When you're writing this book, who did you have in mind as the type of person that you wanted to be reading this book?
Well, I wanted to reach a broad audience because I think my life is emblematic of southern rural people that I think I was told, and I believe we never had a work like this done. I wanted to tell the story of a young African-American boy growing up in the Jim Crow era. And so I just didn't want to reach the African-Americans, but everybody who should know our story, know our experience. And I thought it would be fascinating and insightful and enlightening reading for everybody. It's sort of a historical, not just biographical, but a historical document of what blacks, especially young blacks, experienced in the rural South, small southern town, growing up doing Jim Crow.
Would you say that this book, this story, has a lesson for the reader? And if so, what's the one thing you would like the reader to take away from reading this book?
The lesson would be that in spite of the extremity of the poverty of one's upbringing, there's still some enrichment. And there are things that we often take for granted and we focus on negatives. And I would like for the reader to take out of this that growing up in any place, regardless of how adverse or extreme it might be, can still be enriching and enhancing and can be a place of molding or preparation for where you're going in life.
To give our listeners just a taste of some of the characters and some of the scenes in the book, tell us more.
Okay, well, the book is actually autobiographical, and some of the characters along with me will be my brothers. I had eight brothers and two sisters, and it deals with our sibling rivalry. It deals with domestic violence. My father, he's deceased now, but he was an abuser. He abused my mother. It did with her, and some struggles and issues of what took place in this little rural area. Some struggles of discrimination and bigotry, but yet struggles of triumph and success between my family, even my mother and my father, who overcame the stigma of our area and was able to achieve great things through my father being a businessman, a subcontractor, and through what they were able to achieve in this little small southern town called Nuketown, where we had, I think, two bathrooms in the whole town, dirt roads, and they were able to build a modern house way back then with air conditioning. And so it chronicles these, a lot of these stories are in short form. You know, so a lot of it is hilarious between between me and my brothers and the times that we had, you know, growing up, how we would tease one another, the competitiveness we had, the camaraderie we had, but yet the struggles, the conflicts we had.
Now, how would you say this book and the story within, how would you say it's different and unique and unlike other similar books?
I would say it is different and unique because it has to deal with an individual and his siblings and tell the story that has never really been told about small, rural, southern living of a black family in doing Jim Crow area. I cannot recall reading a book, even a novel, that really pinpointed and chronicled some of the issues and stories that I bring out. Real life stories now. They're real life stories that chronicle that of picking cotton, coming up, picking cotton, having them stay out of school and pick cotton for quite a few weeks before we would go to school, and other stories that told about experiences that I had as a young boy growing up in Nuketown, battling the demons of racism and the demons of domestic violence and other things that I had to contend with during this time as a young black boy who was living in Jim Crow and being told that I was inferior and had little opportunities because in our area we had no businesses, there was no work. Many of our people had to live in the country, did not move from the country. They moved to the town area, but they still couldn't get work. And so they became a part of the great migration north, past the Mason-Dixon line to get jobs. But my parents stayed in this area and was able to overcome the oppression and the bigotry and racism of that time.
Now, when you first published this book, how was it received by the people close to you, your community, your family, your friends? What sort of reaction did you have from people that first read the book?
That's a good question. Many of my brothers didn't agree with it because to them I was revealing skeletons in the closet. There's a chapter in the book about the race of my mother, a bunch of men who came to our house one night when I was about, I don't know, 7, 8 years of age. And they just came in because back then we didn't lock the doors. But, you know, there was no need to lock the doors. And they came in, there was about 6 of them. And we lived in a 4-room house. And they held me and my brothers in the back. And they kept my mother in what we called back then the front room. And they held her down. One guy was on top of her. I managed to break through. You know, the guy that was trying to hold us back, there was 2 of them, but I managed to break through, and what I saw has lived with me and has been a torment. That was one of the things why I wanted to write this to get it out. But my brothers didn't want to remember that. Either they deliberately eradicated it or erased it from their minds, but I guess I always had an acute memory, and I never did forget it. And so that was one of the areas where they didn't want me and didn't like that I mentioned that. I got a whole chapter about that.
Considering how you felt and the memories you had of the experience you've just talked about, how did you feel when you got that kind of reaction from your family to this book?
Well, I considered it, but being a writer, a student of history, and then a theologian, I know that sometimes truth is ugly, but I noticed that even in the Holy Writ, that the Almighty put and allowed some terrible things to be documented about David, another thing that happened. And so I felt that all this was going to be true to history, regardless of how ugly it was and who it might hurt, that I had to record it anyway. So I think they have adjusted to it at first. You know, some of them was, a little disturbed by it and upset. But I think over the process of time, they adjusted to it.
Would you agree that telling a story like this, no matter how difficult it is for those involved, for yourself, for example, would you say that speaking about your experiences and your memories like this helps you to forgive, even in a small way?
I definitely agree to that, sir. I would read this, especially certain chapters, and this in particular, other chapters, and I would cry. Even now when I think about it and read it, it was a type of healing closure for me that even at my age now, after all these years, I was still bothered by the demons of this and other things. But by writing about it, it's almost as if it was therapeutic and healing for me to do that. And so you're definitely right.
What were some of the challenges that you faced when you sat down to write this book? And on the other side of the coin, tell me about some of the rewarding parts when you were writing.
Some of the challenges was, should I or should I not tell the truth? I think that was perhaps the greatest challenge or obstacle that I had to battle, to contend with. Should I or should I not tell the truth about certain events of my family, the domestic violence, and this about the rape of my mother? Other things, but the great challenge. Now, what was rewarding was the fact that I was able to document things about achievements and things that were positive about my father, even though he was a man who was possessed at times with the demon of drinking and of domestic violence, but yet he had great talents and abilities, and he would stand against bigotry at times. And about my mother, she was a virtuous woman, and she was the one who brought me up and brought us up, helped instill within us a Judeo-Christian foundation. And then other people, teachers and mentors that I recall that were so instrumental and foundational in my shaping and making. And then rewarding when I read about the hilarious things. I remember a time when my daddy, one of my brothers in the book, I call him Monkey Beast, and he had a problem wetting the bed, and my daddy gave him an ultimatum, and that is, if he wet the bed on this night, if we slept what we call two up, two down, and maybe two up, one down, because, you know, there were so many of us, and we slept in one room, the brothers did. Well, I slept in the bed with my brother, Monkey Beast. And I had to get up and use the bathroom. We didn't have bathrooms. We had a little viewing pot, a teapot, what they would call it. And I was so scared to get up on that night. And so I told myself, he's going to wet the bed anyway. And so I turned over, and I just let all of it out on his side. Well, this was the very night he didn't wet the bed. And so when my father came in the room and inspected his side of the bed, he rebuked him and he asked him, didn't I tell you not to wet the bed no more? And he said, I didn't wet the bed. And it was almost a dichotomy, you know, that one side, the bed was wet on his side, but some of his underwear wasn't wet. And I kept quiet. I know I was wrong and I had to repent. And we laugh about it now. But it's hilarious when I think about it, when I went on his side and blamed him for something he didn't do.
Now, we've spoken about the book Growing Old in Newtown, but I believe that you've written and published some other books. Tell us some more about that.
Most of my books have been religious in nature. One of the books that I some years ago was called Free at Last, The Reality of Racism in the Church. And in that book, I dealt with the issue of racism in the house of God, you know, from a white perspective and a black perspective. And I dealt with the four kinds of racism. I dealt with racism, I called it place, grace, face, and race. And I said that place racism is people being, you know, proudful and racial about their position and status in life. And then I dealt with grace about their denomination, whether they were Catholic, whether they were Protestant, Pentecostal, or Baptist. And then I dealt with the issue of just the race itself, ethnic racism and bigotry, people being proud and feeling superior to others because of their ethnicity and their race. And so this book dealt with that, and it went way back in scripture to show the origin, the biblical origin of racism, and it gave some, what I felt was some antidotes or some solutions to how racism could be dealt with within the church, because so goes the church, I believe, so goes the world or community.
Thank you. Now, in closing, is there anything that we haven't covered here that you would like to add that you feel is important for people to know, not only about your book, but about the work that you are involved in? And also, if you have any plans for a sequel or possibly some new books about something completely different?
That's a good question. That's a great question. Well, the work that I'm involved in, I am a bishop and a community leader. I'm a columnist who write articles and have a column in our region, a local newspaper, and I enjoy doing that, and I travel extensively to Asia. As a matter of fact, I'm getting ready to go back to South Africa in about a couple of months, and then the first of the year, I'm going over to back to India, and so I give oversight to many churches and pastors, and I serve as a pastor here in our area. And I'm working on, have finished what I believe is going to be an important work, a novel. And I don't want to disclose the nature of it because I don't want to give my secrets away and for plagiarism, so I'm going to steal it. But I just finished a novel that I believe would be the greatest work that I've done. I just finished it. And I'm getting it to those who will beef it up for me and get it, you know, certain ghostwriters who will beef it up. But I just finished it. And so I'm looking forward to the release of that, so hopefully sometime in 2017, maybe the middle part of 2017. It's a great novel. It's of a religious, nature with overtures, but it deals with a lot of intrigue and a lot of adventure and et cetera.
It sounds wonderful, and we very much look forward to hearing more about that and, of course, reading it when it becomes published. Growing Old in Newtown is published by Lulu and is available direct from the publisher at lulu.com and all good book stockists. Once again, I would like to thank my special guest, the author Bishop Michael E. Goings, for joining me today, and we wish him every success. This is Rick Bell for Toginet Radio. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Rick.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up, so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today I have the pleasure of visiting with author Holly L. Springer, who has written her third book titled Waiting for Grace. And I welcome Holly to the program, who is in Pennsylvania in the United States of America. Welcome, Holly, to the program.
Thank you. Welcome, Jay. I appreciate that.
Well, my pleasure. I am looking at your book, and it's described as this on the back. This book walks with its author on the journey to rebuild a life following a brain aneurysm, which had occurred in 2001. So this is your story, correct?
That's correct.
Tell a little of your background and how this happened and what the results were.
Prior to the aneurysm, I was employed by an insurance company as a human resource manager for over 20 years. And the brain aneurysm occurred at work quite suddenly. I had no warning about it. I was very fortunate to be there because they could then, you know, deal with it and take me to the hospital, where they theorized it actually broke either on the way in the ambulance or in the hospital. But anyway, I was flown to another hospital in Philadelphia for the surgery. I was in a coma following the surgery for 7.5 weeks. My family elected to follow the wishes in my living will and pull all the feeding, because the prognosis was, if I'd come out of the coma, that I would be a vegetable. Wow. And could stay that way for up to 20 years, because
wow,
I was 52 years at the time.
Hmm.
So my family did that, called the minister. He came in, said some prayers, and after he left, I woke up.
Wow. That's the term, a miracle, I think, is one way to describe that,
that's
right?
They do call it that, but I would tell you that God and I have had some conversations about this miracle, because as the years have gone off, I've figured out it has come a little bit with strings. But anyway, you know, I equated to, there's a verse in a song that Elvis Presley sang when he's talking to God and said, you know, you've given me a mountain this time. And mm-hmm. So I have to say, yeah, this has been a mountain to deal with all the effects of a brain aneurysm, but it is indeed a miracle that I can even talk about it, which really prompted me to write the books.
Incredible. Your title, Waiting for Grace, I understand there's a Hank involved in this as well. You have
there
a
is.
Hank and a Grace, and what are they? And tell a little about who Hank is and how that fits into the story.
Well, the way they fit into the story is, I am a person who, the one person I'd gone to, the neuropsychologist said, you are one being, but you have two distinct brains.
Right.
Your left side and your right side. And he said, if I would go to a colleague, he said, they would expect to see two distinct people. And he said, you're not. So Hank is a left side, which is virtually unscathed, and has all the attributes of the left side working perfectly, while right side, which was very much damaged, is Grace. And that side of the brain is the one that's a little bit more, I wouldn't say frivolous, but more spontaneous is a better word.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always waiting for her. Now, on top of that, the aneurysm did some damage to the brain, most noticeably to the cerebellum, which runs across the bottom, which was severely damaged, and pace center and vision. But I'm always feeling I'm waiting for this right side to get in sync with the left side. And so that's why I entitled it that way, Waiting for Grace. But also, I love the name Grace, because grace implies so many things. You know, how you move with grace, a grace of your life. So, but that's why I'm waiting. I'm always waiting for that right side to get in sync with the left side. And some days it's a long, long wait, Jay. That's all I can say.
Right. And Grace, the personality of, not the personality of Grace, but the attributes of Grace, or the right side of the brain, right hemisphere, is you are missing that spontaneity. Did you have that prior to the aneurysm?
I would say I did. And while I have it, probably what I miss most is that right side is, maybe, I wouldn't say I've lost it. I would say in some ways it's more pronounced, that I'm always waiting for the spontaneity to catch up with a reasonable side, and it kind of wants to do its own thing. I don't know if I changed too much in personality. I'm sure I did after I had the aneurysm.
Right.
Because I think any trauma to the brain affects you and affects you differently. But I know my personality changed for a while because my daughter would always have to be apologizing to nurses because I would just slip out and say things. And she said, that's not my mother. That's not how she is. And certainly being in human resources, I had the skills to know not to do certain things. So that caught up. But when I had the aneurysm, I know I had long-term memory. So even though I knew my kids were my children, I had no history with them. Now, all that's come back. And some things will stay with me probably forever as damaged areas. I mean, I can't grow back the brain that's dead.
Right.
But the rest of the brain is trying to compensate for that.
The initial indication that you had something going on at work, what was that, and what would my listeners have found in that situation?
I went into work, and I complained about a ferocious headache,
right,
which was, you know, a headache like I never had before. And I must have known somebody was wrong. I cleaned up my office. I went in a coworker, and I told her to call an ambulance. I said, something is very wrong. And then I got violently sick. And where I was employed in the office, they had rehab nurses. And my coworker in her office was going to have me put my head between my knees. And one of the nurses came in and said, no, don't do that. We think we know what this is. Just let her lie flat. So that is a big thing. And you read about that. Mm-hmm. Then an aneurysm, one of the symptoms is this ferocious headache. And I never had headaches, never had migraines, which my whole family had to be tested for aneurysms because my daughter has migraines. So they want to make sure that, you know, nobody's going to have something that lies there as it's a little dormant aneurysm. So that was the big thing. And I have to say that was a blessing because had I had that headache to that extreme, I might have caught in work and stayed home. Mm-hmm. I would have passed away because I did die twice that morning. So, I mean, that was a blessing to be where people could come to me and help me.
As someone who is not well-versed in the medical profession, is the aneurysm result or aneurysm symptom, is it similar to a stroke or is it the same thing?
Well, I guess it falls under the stroke after you've had it because they put me with the National Stroke Connection.
Right.
And I kept saying I had an aneurysm and said, we kind of put in the same category. And I guess the symptoms, to answer your question, kind of would be like the same, other than I've never had a stroke. And I know that sometimes when you have a clot, you know, you just pass out and you have a part of your body is not going to react the same way.
Right.
And that could have happened because this was on the right side. And oddly enough, they were telling me that the aneurysm happened on the right side, which then would have meant that everything on your left side should have been affected. And they're saying, oddly enough, it's your right side that's weaker than the left side.
Interesting.
And mine was, they theorized congenital. I had fallen as a child, and they told me that all the arteries in the back of the head were all distorted. And they theorized that when I fell, that the brain protected itself around this area by making other convoluted pathways. And, of course, I never knew I had this until this happened. And I say, thank goodness, because, you know, when I had my two children, that would have been a very, very advantageous time for a weak artery to burst.
Wow. Well, there's a lot of focus on head injuries right now in sports and other areas.
Yes,
will your book have some validity to a parent who wants to read and find out a little bit about your journey and how maybe to prevent head injuries in their family?
I don't know if I'd say prevent it, but I would say it should give them insight into if they've had a head injury, what living with traumatic brain injury might be like, not so much for them as much as it is for the child and what they're going through. I would say I'm a perfect example of what you see is not what is with me. I mean, I've been told I look normal, that, you know, everything looks fine. Internally, I feel like I walk like a demented duck. I have all these other issues. And I would think somebody who has traumatic brain injury is going to be very, very close to that. And they're not going to be expressed that, But the parents should understand that, that, you know, it's very difficult when you're not walking in that person's shoes. So my books would give you some insight as to perhaps how to relate to the person, not just flu it off, that they don't feel there's something wrong, because indeed they do feel there's something wrong, and that to be understanding about that.
That's a great point. I have a friend who, in his work environment, suffered a head injury maybe 25 years ago, and now is seeing the results or seeing the effect of that. It's starting to hit in his older life.
Right. Well, see, he might even enjoy reading the book, because it's like, my message is don't give up. You know, and you look at life so very differently. But, I mean, there were times, Jay, I was so frustrated that I really felt like I could just step off a curb, which I can't do because I can't step off a curb, and walk in front of a truck.
Wow.
And then I thought, well, this would be cute, Holly, because, you know, your walking is more like Tim Conway shuffling as an old man. And by the time you got halfway to the street, the truck would be 3 miles down the street.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I really couldn't do that to somebody. But, I mean, there's a distortion as to thinking there's something you can do. And the reality of it is your body does not perform the same way anymore. And you've got to get used to that. And it probably never will. But, okay, does that mean you're going to stop living? And I vowed early on, I'm not going to be a victim by this. I'm not going to let my life be a victim. There's just too much I feel that I want to do and would like to do to be victimized by my own body and by my own thinking.
Well, your 78 pages, you have included sort of conversations with others as though it were contemporary with the writing of the book. How long did it take you, Holly, to complete the book?
Well, now this one took me, I would have to say, 3 years, only because I kept going back and forth, and I had to be in the mood. And quite frankly, there were days where mentally I just was not in a good place. The other ones were a lot quicker to do, but this one, until I finally put things together and said, you know, Holly, live with it, because, you know, you're getting older and the brain trauma is not going to leave you. So you've got a decision: either sit down and finish this thing and go on with your life, or wrap yourself up in a ball and just throw yourself off the deck. And so I said, you know what, let's just get it done.
The conversational passages, are those, were those actual conversations? Were they remembered conversations? How would you describe those?
You mean the conversations with Hank and Grace?
Well, I think so, yes. You're talking about Grace, and you say, tell me about your travels, Grace. I mean, this is...
Yes. Those are conversations that mentally I have, that, you know, I just sit and can very quietly, have to be quiet, and I can just, you know, there's times when I could just hear that, probably more Hank, because he's around more, that he would just get frustrated and say, oh, my God, you know, where is this Grace at this point? And Holly, you've got to get yourself off that chair. And he's the one that said, you've got to finish this. You know, you started this 3 years ago. Now, just finish it. You've got to do something. And I'm not going to stand here waiting in the back wings until your right side is going flaky back and forth and can't decide what to do. Just get your act together and get it done. So that's Hank.
That's Hank.
And
yep.
That's Hank.
Again,
he's always behind me, pushing me. And Grace is kind of off in la-la land, which is why I can see by the cover she kind of is this busy woman with a smile on her face, because she's off in la-la land thinking, well, now what can we do today that might be fun and interesting? And Hank is back there saying, you know, Grace, just do something.
Well, 78 pages, and you've done a commendable job. What is your hope for the book? This is more than just someone talking to themselves. I mean, it really does have some wonderful insight. How would you describe this to someone?
Well, I think, to me, it's like really apropos to anybody not just going through an aneurysm or a stroke, any medical issue or any really life issue which completely alters where your path is going, is to say, you know what, read it, and maybe you'll come away with some tidbits of how to rearrange your thinking in your life, and to more important, understand yourself and understand that things will be okay. You know, your life has changed. I know that. I mean, I know there's so many things that alter a person's life. But you've got to learn how to alter yourself with it. I love a certain quote I had. It's really part of a passage, and it really states that you have to learn how to be the master of your fate and the captain of your soul. That you are their own first, your best advocate. Nobody walks in your shoes. Nobody can walk in your shoes. And I don't think that you can walk in somebody else's either. But you've got to decide where you want to be. Do you want to be sitting on the shelf, or do you want to still be part of life? And I guess I've decided, well, Holly, you can be one of the two, but wouldn't it be much more fun to be part of life while you still have it? Because, you know, my aneurysm taught me, hey, it's not guaranteed tomorrow.
Fabulous.
Tomorrow's never guaranteed for anybody.
Holly, you have written other books. What are the titles? And share that with my listeners.
The first one is called Hello Tomorrow, I'm Still Here. And that's about my journey back from having the aneurysm into the new world I find myself in. My second book is called Negotiating the Speed Bumps, Living with Traumatic Brain Injury. And that is explaining to the reader and to actually to my family what it's like for a person who has traumatic brain injury, what it's like from their end, so that trying to tell them that what you necessarily see in a person isn't what they're experiencing, and hopefully you get an education how to deal with that person.
Oh, that's fabulous. This is an inspirational and insightful read, 78 pages or so, and it's titled Waiting for Grace. My guest author, Holly L. Springer. Holly, my listeners will need to get a copy of this. How do they do so?
Well, I'm sure they can go to Lulu Publishing. I know it's on Amazon, so I would think that they have it almost on every place you can buy books online. I'm sure it's there. You know, since it's self-published, it's not in the library. But I know Lulu Publisher was behind it, and I think if you just put a title search in, you'll find it. But I know it's on Amazon. It's probably on Barnes & Noble. Not long either. I like that. You know, 70-some pages, you can probably read it in a couple hours, and maybe you'll walk away with something you didn't do before or didn't know before, or a new insight into life.
Well, thank you, Holly, for joining me today and sharing your insight. And again, it's inspirational and insightful. A great read, 78 pages, Waiting for Grace, a clever title. Holly L. Springer, if you want to do a search online and find out about the other things that she has penned, other books she has penned, that would be a great way to connect with her. Thank you, Holly, for joining me today.
Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.